Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin has characterized herself as a timid and conservative feminist at first, one who wrote as an honorary man. Her early fiction was male-centered, populated by male heroes, and reflective of the tradition of the 1960s, when few women, with the notable exception of writers like Joanna Russ, experimented in the field. Soon she realized that she could no longer ignore the feminine and began perusing feminist theory in order to discover how to write about women. She calls the Norton Book of Literature by Women a Bible that taught her how to write like a woman. The Rock That Changed Things suggests the overthrow of a ruling class by members of a less respected social order, but also can be approached as a parable of evolving attitudes toward literature and the environment. The story upsets the premise that superiority justifies subordination, whether obols are oppressing nurs or whether college professors are questioning the inclusion of multicultural, feminist, and science fiction works to the long-standing literary canon. In addition, the following story explores hierarchical relationships of reason and emotion, linear thinking and circular reasoning, and of masculine and feminine in order to overturn the notions that one element is inferior to the other. Reflecting Le Guin's abiding use of Taoist imagery, the story also portrays the idea of balance, ordered completeness, and cyclical history that is continually examined throughout her prose. This story also exemplifies the reconnoitering of the mechanistic perspective of our universe, superseded by the more current awareness of the web of life. The Rock That Changed Things. A neurobal called Boo, working one day with her crew on the rock pile of Obling College, found the rock that changed things. Where the obols live, the shores of the river are rocky. Boulders, large stones, small stones, pebbles, and gravel lie piled and scattered for miles up and down the banks. The towns of the obols are built of stone. They hunt the rock coney for their meat feasts. Their neurobles gather and prepare stone crop and lichen for ordinary food and build the houses and the colleges and keep them neat, for the obols grow nervous and unhappy when things are not kept in order. The heart of an obol town is its college, and the pride of every college is its terraces, which shelve down towards the river from the high stone buildings. The stones of the terraces are arranged according to size. Boulders make the outer walls, and within them are rows of large rocks, then banks of small stones, and at last the inner terraces of pebbles, set in elaborate mosaics and patterns in gravel. On the terraces the obols stroll and sit in the long warm days, smoking ta leaf in pipes of soapstone and discussing history, natural history, philosophy, and metaphysics. So long as the rocks are arranged in order of shape and size and the patterns are kept clear and tidy, the obols have peace of mind and can think deeply. After their conversations on the terraces, the wisest old obols enter the colleges and write down the best of what was thought and said in the books of record that are kept neatly arranged on the shelves of the college libraries. When the river floods in early spring and rises up the terraces, tumbling the rocks about, washing the gravel away, and causing great disorder, the obols stay inside the colleges. There they read the books of record, discuss and annotate, plan new designs for the terraces, eat meat feasts, and smoke. Their nurs cook and serve the feasts, and keep the rooms of the colleges orderly. As soon as the floods pass, the nurs begin to sort the rocks and straighten up the terraces. They hurry to do so because the disorder left by the floods makes the obols very nervous. And when they are nervous, they beat and rape the nurs more harshly than usual. The spring floods this year had broken through the boulder wall of the town of Opling, leaving branches and driftwood and other litter on the terraces, and disturbing or destroying many of the patterns. The terraces of Opling College are notable for the perfect order and complex beauty of their pebble patterns. Famous Obels have spent years of their lives designing the patterns and choosing the stones. One great designer, Agnegni, is said to have worked with his own hands to perfect his creation. If a single pebble is lost from such a design, the Nerobles will spend days hunting through the rock piles for a replacement of precisely the right shape and size. On such a task, the Neroble called Boo was engaged along with her crew when she came upon the stone that changed things. When replacement rocks are needed, the rock pile Ners often make a rough copy of that section of the terrace mosaic so that they can test pebbles in it for fit without carrying them all the way up to the inner terraces. Boo had placed a trial stone in a test pattern in this fashion and was gazing at it to be sure the size and shape were exact, when she was struck by a quality of the stone which she had never noticed before, the color. The pebbles of this part of the design were all large ovals, a palm and a quarter wide and a palm and a half long. The rock Boo had just set into the test pattern was a perfect quarter-half oval, and so fit exactly. But while the other rocks were mostly a dark, smooth-grained, bluish-gray, the new one was a vivid blue-green with flecks of paler jade-green. Boo knew, of course, that the color of a rock is a matter of absolute indifference, an accidental and trivial quality that does not affect the true pattern in any way. All the same, she found herself gazing with peculiar satisfaction at this blue-green stone. Presently, she thought, "This stone is beautiful." She was not looking, as she should have been, at the whole design, but at the one stone, whose color was set off by the duller hue of the others. She was strangely moved. Strange thoughts arose in her mind. She thought, "This stone is significant. It means. It is a word." She picked it up and held it while studying the test pattern. The original design up on the terrace was called the Dean's Design for the Dean of the College, Festy, who had planned this section of the terraces. When Boo replaced the blue-green stone in the pattern, it still caught her eye by its color, distracting her mind from the pattern. But she could not see any meaning in it. She took the blue-green stone to the rock pile Forner and asked him if he saw anything wrong or odd or particular about the stone. The Forner gazed thoughtfully at the stone, but at last opened his eyes wide, meaning no. Boo took the stone up to the inner terraces and set it into the true pattern. It fitted the Dean's design exactly. Its shape and size were perfect. But standing back to study the pattern, Boo thought it scarcely seemed to be the Dean's design at all. It was not that the new stone changed the design. It simply completed a pattern that Boo had never realized was there, a pattern of color that had little or no relation to the shape and size arrangement of the Dean's design. The new stone completed a spiral of blue-green stones within the field of interlocked rhomboids of quarter-half ovals that formed the center of Festy's design. Most of the blue-green stones were ones that Boo had laid over the past several years, but the spiral had been begun by some other Ner before Boo was promoted to the Dean's design. Just then, Dean Festy came strolling out in the spring sunshine, his rusty gun on his shoulder, his pipe in his mouth, happy to see the disorder of the floods being repaired. The Dean was a kind old Opal who had never raped Boo, though he often patted her. Boo summoned up her courage, hid her eyes, and said, "Lord Dean, sir, Would the Lord Dean, in his knowledge, be so good as to tell me the verbal significance of this section of the true pattern which I have just repaired? Dean Festy paused, perhaps a touch displeased to be interrupted in his meditations. But seeing the young Nur so modestly crouching and hiding all her eyes, he patted her in a forbearing way and said, "Certainly. This subsection of my design may be read on the simplest level as, I place stones beautifully, or I place stones in excellent order. There is an imminent higher plane post-verbal significance, of course, as well as the ineffable arcana. But you needn't bother your little head with that." "Is it possible," the Nur asked in a submissive voice, "to find a meaning in the colors of the stones?" The Dean smiled again and patted her in several places. "Who knows what goes on in the heads of Nurs? Color. Meaning in color. Now run along, little Nurblet. You've done very pretty repair work here. Very neat, very nice." And he strolled on, puffing on his pipe and enjoying the spring sunshine. Boo returned to the rock pile to sort stones, but her mind was disturbed. All night she dreamed of the blue-green rock. In the dream, the rock spoke, and the rocks about it in the pattern began speaking too. Waking, Boo could not remember the words the stones had said. The sun was not up yet, but the Nurs were, and Boo spoke to several of her nestmates and work friends while they fed and cleaned the blitz and ate their hurried breakfast of cold-fried lichen. "Come up onto the terraces now before the opals are up," Boo said. "I want to show you something." Boo had many friends, and 8 or 9 Nurs followed her up onto the terraces, some of them bringing their nursing or toddling blitz along. "What's Boo got in her head this time?" they said to each other, laughing. "Now look," Boo said when they were all on the part of the inner terrace that Dean Fester had designed. "Look at the patterns, and look at the colors of the rocks." "Colors don't mean anything," said one Nur and another. "Colors aren't part of the patterns, Boo." "But what if they were?" said Boo. "Just look." The Nurs, being used to silence and obedience, looked. "Well," said one of them after a while, "isn't that amazing?" "Look at that," said Boo's best friend, Ko. "That spiral of blue-green running all over the Dean's design. And there's 5 red hematites around a yellow sandstone, like a flower. This whole section in brown basalt, it cuts across the real pattern, doesn't it?" said little Ga. "It makes another pattern, a different pattern," Boo said. "Maybe it makes an imminent pattern of ineffable significance." "Oh, come off it, Boo," said Ko. "You a professor or something?" The others laughed, but Boo was too excited to see that she was funny. "No," she said earnestly, "but look, that blue-green rock there, the last one in the spiral." "Serpentinite," said Ko. "Yes, I know, but if the Dean's design means something, he said that part means, I place stones beautifully. Well, could the blue-green rock be a different word with a different meaning?" "What meaning?" "I don't know. I thought you might know." Boo looked hopefully at Un, an elderly Nur who, though he had been lamed in a rock slide in his youth, was so good at fine pattern maintenance that the obols had let him live. Un stared at the blue-green stone and at the curve of blue-green stones, and at last said slowly, "It might say, the Nur places stones." "What Nur?" Ko asked. "Boo," little Ga said. "She did place the stone." Boo and Un both opened their eyes wide to signify no. "Patterns aren't ever about Nurs," said Ko. "Maybe patterns made of colors are," said Boo, getting excited and blinking very fast. The Nur, said Ko, following the blue-green curve with all three eyes. The Nur places stones beautifully in uncontrollable loopingness. My goodness, what's that all about? He read on along the curve. In uncontrollable loopinginess, four. What's that? Oh, foreshadowing the scene. The vision, Un suggested. The vision of, I don't know the last word. Are you seeing all that in the colors of the rocks? Asked Ga, amazed. In the patterns of the colors, Boo replied. They aren't accidental, not meaningless. All the time we have been putting them here in patterns. Not just the ones the obols design and we execute, but other patterns, Nur patterns, with new meanings. Look at them. Since they were used to silence and obedience, they all stood and looked at the patterns on the inner terraces of the College of Obling. They saw how the arrangement by shape and size of the pebbles and larger stones made regular squares, oblongs, triangles, dodecahedrons, zigzags, and rectilinear designs of great and orderly beauty and significance. And they saw how the arrangement of the stones by color had created other designs, less complete, often merely sketched or hinted, circles, spirals, ovals, and complex curvilinear mazes and labyrinths of great and unpredictable beauty and significance. So a long loop of white quartzites cut right across the quarter-palm straight-edge double line, and the rhomboid section of half-palm sandstones seemed to be an element in a long crescent of pale yellow. Both patterns were there. Did one cancel the other, or was each part of the other? It was difficult to see them both at once, but not impossible. After a long time, little Ga asked, did we do all that without even knowing we were doing it? I always looked at the colors of the rocks, Un said in a low voice, looking down. So did I, Ko said, and the grain and texture, too. I started that wiggly part in the crystal angles, pointing at a very ancient and famous section of the terrace, designed by the great Oholothal. Last year, after the late flood, when we lost so many stones from the design, remember? I got a lot of amethyst from the Ubi Caves. I love purple. His tone was defiant. Boo looked at a circle of small, smooth turquoises inlaid in a corner of a set of interlocked rectangles. I like blue-green, Boo said in a whisper. I like blue-green. He likes purple. We see the colors of the stones. We make the pattern. We make the pattern beautifully. Should we tell the professors, do you think? Little Ga asked, getting excited. They might give us extra food. Old Un opened all his eyes very wide. Don't breathe a word of this to the professors. They don't like patterns to change. You know that. It makes them nervous. They might get nervous and punish us. We are not afraid, Boo said in a whisper. They wouldn't understand, Ko said. They don't look at colors. They don't listen to us. And if they did, they'd know it was just nerves talking and didn't mean anything, wouldn't they? But I'm going back to the caves and get some more amethyst and finish that wiggly part. Pointing to the crystal angles, where repairs had scarcely begun. They'll never even see it. Ga's naughty little blit, Professor Endel's son, was digging up pebbles from the superior triangle and had to be spanked. Oh, Ga sighed, he's all oblit. I just don't know what to do with him. He'll go to school next year, Un said dryly. They'll know what to do with him. But what will I do without him, said Ga. The sun was well up in the sky now, and professors could be seen looking out from their bedroom windows over the terraces. They would not like to see nerves loitering, and small blits were, of course, absolutely forbidden within the college walls. Boo and the others hastily returned to the nests and workhouses. Ko went to the Ubi Caves that same day, and Boo went along. They came back with sacks of fine amethysts and worked for several days completing the wiggly part, which they called the purple waves, in the repair and maintenance of the crystal angles. Ko was happy in the work and sang and joked, and at night he and Boo made love. But Boo remained preoccupied. She kept studying the patterns of color on the terraces and finding more and more of them and more meanings and ideas in them. "Are they all about Nurs?" Old Un asked. His arthritis kept him from the terraces, but Boo reported her findings to him every day. "No," Boo said, "most of them are about Obels and Nurs both, and Blitz too. But Nurs made them, so they're different. Obel patterns are never really about Nurs, only about Obels and what Obels think. But when you begin to read the colors, they say the most interesting things." Boo was so excited and persuasive that other Nurs of Obling began studying the color patterns, learning how to read their meanings. The practice spread to other nests and soon to other towns. Before long, Nurs all up and down the river were discovering that their terraces, too, were full of wild designs in colored stones and surprising messages concerning Obels, Nurs, and Blitz. Many Nurs, however, upset by the whole idea, steadfastly refused to see patterns in color, or to allow that the color of a stone could have any significance at all. "The Obels count on us not to change things," these Nurs said. "We are their Nur Obels. They depend on us to keep their patterns neat and keep the Blitz quiet and maintain order, so that they can do important work. If we start inventing new meanings, changing things, disturbing the patterns, where will it end? It isn't fair to the Obels." Boo, however, would hear none of that. She was full of her discovery. She no longer listened in silence. She spoke. She went about among the workhouses speaking. And one evening, summoning up her courage and wearing around her neck on a thong a perfect, polished turquoise that she called her self-stone, she went up onto the terraces. She crossed the terraces among the startled professors and came to the rectory mosaic, where Astel, the rectoress, a famous scholar, strolled in solitary meditation, her ancient rifle slung on her back, wreaths of smoke trailing from her reeking pipe. Not even a full professor would have interrupted the rectoress at such a sacred time. But Boo went straight to her, crouched, covered her eyes, and said, in a tremulous but clear voice, "Lady Rectoress, ma'am, would the Lady Rectoress in her kindness answer a question I have?" The rectoress was truly displeased and upset by this disorderly behavior. She turned to the nearest professor and said, "This Nur is insane. Have it removed, please." Boo was sentenced to 10 days in jail, to be raped by students whenever they pleased, and then sent to the flagstone quarries for 100 days. When she returned to the nest, she was pregnant from one of the rapes, and quite thin from working in the quarries, but she still wore her turquoise stone. All her nestmates and work friends greeted her, singing songs which they had made out of the meanings of the colored patterns on the terraces. Ko comforted her with tender affection that night, and told her that her blit would be his blit, and her nest his nest. Not many days after, she entered the college, via the kitchens, and made her way, with the assistance of the serving nurse, to the private room of the canon. The canon of Obling College was a very old Obel, renowned for his knowledge of metaphysical linguistics. He woke slowly mornings. This morning he woke slowly and gazed with some puzzlement at the serving nerve which had come to open his curtains and serve his breakfast. It seemed to be a different one. He almost reached for his gun, but was too sleepy. "Hello," he said. "You're new, aren't you?" "I want you to answer a question I have," said the nerve. The cannon woke further and stared at this amazing creature. "At least have the decency to cover your eyes, Nur," he said, but he was not really very upset. He was so old that he was no longer quite sure what the patterns were, and so a change in them did not trouble him as much as it might have done. "Nobody else can answer me," said the Nur. "Please do. Do you know if a blue-green stone in a pattern might be a word?" "Oh, yes, indeed," said the cannon, becoming alert. "Although, of course, all verbal color significance is long obsolete, of mere antiquarian interest to old fuddy-duddies such as myself, ha! Hue words don't occur even in the most archaic patterns, only in the most ancient books of record." "What does it mean?" The canon wondered if he were dreaming. Discussing historical linguistics with a Nur before breakfast? But it was an entertaining dream. "The hue of blue-green, such as that stone you seem to be wearing as an ornament, might, in its adjectival form within a pattern, have indicated a quality of untrammeled volition. As a noun, the color would have functioned to signify, how shall I put it, an absence of coercion, a lack of control, a condition of self-determination." "Freedom," the nurse said. "Does it mean freedom?" "No, my dear," said the canon. "It did, but it does not."
"Why?"
"Because the word is obsolete," said the canon, beginning to tire of this inexplicable dialogue. "Now go away like a good nurse and tell my servant to bring my breakfast." "Look out the window," the wild-eyed nurse said, in so passionate a voice that the canon was quite alarmed. "Look out the window at the terraces. Look at the colors of the stones. Look at the patterns the nurs make, the designs we have made, the meanings we have written. Look for the freedom. Oh, please do look." And with that final plea, the amazing apparition vanished. The canon lay staring at his bedroom door, and in a moment it opened. His old serving nur came in with his tray of stonecrop tea and smoking hot kippered lichen. "Good morning, Lord Canon, sir," she said cheerfully. "Awake already? A lovely morning." And after setting down the tray by his bed, she swept the curtains open wide. "Was there a young nur in here just now?" the canon asked rather nervously. "Certainly not, sir, at least not that I know of," said the serving nur. "But did she for a moment glance quite directly, knowingly? Did she have the audacity to look at him? Surely not." "Lovely the terraces are this morning," she went on. "Your canonitude ought to have a look." "Get out, out," the canon growled, and the nur left with a demure curtsy covering her eyes. The canon ate his breakfast in bed and then got up. He went to the window to look out on the terraces of his college in the morning light. For a moment, he thought he was dreaming again, seeing entirely different patterns than those he had seen all his long life on those terraces. Wild designs of curves and colors, amazing phrases, unimagined significances, a wonderful newness of meaning and beauty. And then he opened all his eyes wide, very wide, and blinked. And it was gone. The familiar, true order of the terraces lay clear and regular in the morning light, and there was nothing else to see. The canon turned away from the window and opened a book. So he did not see the long line of nurobles coming up from the nests and workhouses down below the boulder walls, carrying blitz and dancing as they came,
dancing and singing across the terraces. He heard the singing, but only as a noise without significance. It was not until the first rock flew through his window that he looked up and cried out in agitation, "What is the meaning of this?"